This is Guyon on Sunday morning, the last of his four sessions. Season of the Rose 2016.
So we've been taking as our focus this week the 10th Sufi thought. That begins with the words, there is one path, the annihilation of the false self into the real. And we've been focusing on certain perspectives about how that process works and how to lend ourselves to that process. How to make the soil of our being conducive to that process, which is inherent, it's natural. Just like we see it's natural for to plant a tomato seed and the tomato grows, or a baby comes out of the womb and grows, develops. So there is a developmental imperative. But when it comes to the awakening of consciousness to reality, there's an added element, which is that the human being is capable of participating. In fact, something is required of us. So how does one become unfoldable? How does one become a true student? So one tip is in the phrase of the 10th Sufi thought, the word real. We see that what's real is revealed at deeper and deeper levels. Pirzia's teaching this morning was a very good example of that. Like, we don't usually sit here and realize that we're bathing in light and we are made of light. So discovering what's real has dimensions and is a process, but if we just focus on the word real for a moment, we can only start where we're at. And one of the orientations of the soil of unfoldment is to have absolute fealty to being real as we can. As much as we're able, and we're limited, no spin, no denial. Our orientation, it's not that we're tyrannical to be perfect, but our orientation is a devotion to being as real as we can. What we prefer to feel is less important than what we actually feel. Having integrity to our experience is more important than presenting a persona to be seen in a certain way. The alignment with being real is an ongoing dedication to be practiced. it puts us on a course. However, at the same time, there's a balancing quality or principle, and that's openness. We often hear people say, I'm telling my truth, or being my truth. And there's something in that statement that shows a dedication to the real. But if it does not include another aspect of being a true student, which is the openness that comes from a humility of knowing that I don't see all that there is. So there's the dedication to being real, but simultaneously there's a sense of alertness to what I don't yet see or know, which makes us humble and influenceable and receptive. So there's a fealty to the truth, and simultaneously there's a receptivity to discover. As it turns out, the more we discover what is real, the more positive it is. I mean, think about it. Why would it be that way? If we peel off the layers and get to what is more real and more true, it turns out that it's good. It's a good thing. That's awesome. And I think we intuitively know that because how earnest we are about digging. We know somewhere if we can get home or get to the heart of the matter, that it's the resolution, it's the answer. One of the things we've been exploring this week, for those of you who have been coming to this class, is some of what has to be peeled away, or that we have to go through often, or that we are allowed to go through, you might say, privileged to go through, to peel back the layers to discover what is more real. Because the goodness, the light that turns out to be the fundamental reality, is a light that is independent of outer life. It's like we all know the happiness and the light and the optimism that comes, like if you're hoping to get a job and you get a phone call and they say, we want you. And our whole being brightens up and we're happy and like life is looking good. Or if you're interested in somebody romantically and then you find out they like you too. You know, and like we brighten up. That brightness, that optimism, when the sun comes out, is contingent. It's contingent on what happens out here. And as we've been exploring this week, sometimes things go well and sometimes they don't. The spiritual dimension, what it offers, what it reveals, is that there is something inherent. You can call it divine. You can call it true nature, which is a brightness of being, a here-ness that does not eclipse, does not go into the shadows based on what's happening in life. The radiant one that we are made of. I'll tell you a recent story of my own process around this. Some of you may know that I'm a songwriter, and I recently wrote a song that was working through my anguish about the environmental crisis. The song is called Earth on Fire, Hearts on Ice. And as I was in the process of writing the song over a course of a couple of months, it was very troubling to come into more direct contact with the reality of the desecration of the planet and the implications for my children and grandchildren. And it was also surprisingly, in some ways, the process took me to an encounter with what I would call evil. As I was in the process of writing the song, I thought about like the executives at Monsanto or at Exxon who actually know what they're doing and do it anyway. And like I realized part of me is still kind of innocent. That was shocking to me. And the process of writing the song, there were times in those months when I was experiencing a lot of melancholy and a kind of bad taste in my heart about kind of living with this. And I began asking myself, not so much intellectually, but as a contemplation, how can the spirit of optimism survive the facts that I'm seeing? So I completed the song, which turns out to be more like in the tonality of like a protest song, like a Bob Dylan song from the 60s or something. And it's funny because I felt I could understand the archetype of the Old Testament prophets who are looking at the blindness of humanity and shaking their fists, condemning. But then the song was complete, but my process continued, and I continued to live with this question about the spirit of optimism, which had felt eclipsed for a number of weeks. I was completely embedded in the world on the surface for that time. Maybe not completely, because there's still a sense of like, okay, I know you're not here, but I know I'm speaking to the beloved, speaking to the light. I know I can't feel you right now, but I know you by your absence. As the process continued, something started to a quality of being or a state of being started to arise. And it was exactly this. It was the light of optimism. Which Merchant says that optimism is the I wish I had the passage. Optimism is the expression of love, the force of love, and it is love trusting love. And this state started to arise, and what was curious is nothing had changed on the outside. The climate situation is the same, and a kind of happiness and a lightheartedness became present for no good reason. It does not mean that it drives out sorrow, and it does not mean that it makes one passive in terms of having to ask oneself, what is my responsibility in the realm of action? They're not mutually exclusive. But to the extent that we are in touch with, in some kind of ground, a light, an optimism, that is inextinguishable. Our words, our actions, are the rippling effect of just our state of being can be a balm in the world. One of the things we've discovered or explored this week, and maybe some of you know about or have touched into this week, is the role of disappointment and loss in discovering this ground. That it could be the person we're interested in and we would like to have a romantic relationship falls in love with somebody else. Or it can be that they love us too and we come together and then we discover that they have terminal cancer. These two are the faces of life. If one does not succumb to some kind of permanent disappointment, some kind of fatal bitterness about life, but stays true to the alchemy that disappointment offers, stay true to the feeling, takes us to a certain kind of understanding, a certain kind of place of living that moves through the vicissitudes reliably, steadily, with integrity. It is a place that is no longer has a complaint. To see the location of being that shines and is not dependent on external circumstances. Would you like some water? One of the main avenues to touch that place is presence. That light that is untouchable is what is here when we are not seeing through the veils of history, of our historical impressions. The sheer here-ness has the quality of radiance. The part of the veils that need to be seen through are various habits or patterns of mind. Some of those are psychological. Our hearts have received blows in life, and there can be habits of caution, defensiveness, muted. And that comes into play not just in relationship with people, but it comes into play in terms of how we encounter the moment. To be completely unveiled for this breath. But there's also habits of seeing that are deeper than that, which have to do with the mental buffer of concepts, of reification. I remember being so struck. Maybe some of you have had this experience going to Paris a few years ago and particularly going to the D'Orsay Museum. Have any of you ever been to D'Orsay? And looking at the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists and seeing that what they were attempting to do, how dedicated they were to seeing things fresh, to seeing things as they were, not mediated by concepts. Like, you look at a tree and we're too patterned to see that the light and the colors and the movement, our minds say tree, And immediately there's a distance between what is actually there and our image, our imagery. So part of what we practice in spiritual practice is the becoming conscious of mental veils and the veils on the heart, all the things that it's not our fault, it's kind of wired into our being here as humans. But as we start to consciously be on the spiritual path, we have more choice and things become apparent. And I can start to be more conscious of my looking, conscious of my listening, conscious of my feeling, fresh. And it's that freshness, that immediacy, which begins to reveal this state, not somewhere else, that is not a historical patterned self. We see this in children. They're less patterned. And that kind of brightness and that kind of unveiled, vulnerable, open encounter with life is there. And you're around a little child and it's just intoxicating. You know, you say, I want some of that. So just to kind of reemphasize or repeat kind of the lay of the land of what we've been tracking this week, some of the journey to this ground, the groundless ground, is brought to us by the loving hand of guidance through various kinds of losses, like the things outwardly that we thought we could depend on or we thought was it. When that is at times taken away, then the deeper, truer it becomes I'll tell you another personal story. Some of you might know this. In December of 2008, I had been retired for, I think, 5 months. Retired meant that I had gradually phased out my day job and was going to be able to do Sufi things and music full time. And you know, I'd had a profession for 25 years and been saving and saving and saving. And finally had enough so that living modestly, I didn't have to make choices about what I did with my day based on income. So that was like a 25-year project, and that felt great. And so in December of 2008, I was working at my desk, and a friend called and said, you better turn on the TV. They're taking Bernard Madoff away in handcuffs. And that's where my whole life savings was. So that was shocking. And I didn't sleep much that night. And the next day, it was very beautiful, actually. our children called and said, you could come live with us. And my other son, who's single, and I would want to live with him. Could barely get the door open to his apartment. All the dirty laundry. But he was looking on the internet at double-wide trailers. Because we assumed we were going to have to sell our house. I mean, everything was all bets off. And the next night, I think it was, I applied what I've learned from my spiritual teachers and from my spiritual practice. And I sat down and I said, okay, what's everything you're afraid of? And I said, okay, I'm afraid that my wife's going to get sick and we won't be able to afford health care. It's a very real possibility. And then I just let myself have all kinds of, like, these were fears. They might not have been rational, but I was afraid we'd be living in cardboard boxes on the street. And I just let myself know what all those fears were, and each one of them, I just looked it dead in the eye. And by morning, I had this feeling, whatever happens, we can handle it. And in the days and weeks that followed, and this is the point I think we all can relate to, in the days and weeks that followed, I realized I had been given an initiation. I had not known consciously that I believed that the bank account was the ground that held me. And when that ground was taken away, because all that is not ultimately real will be taken away, and that gift revealed the groundless ground. That which is ultimately dependable. It does not mean that the money will come back, and it's possible that I will be living in a cardboard box, but all is well is here. And I could not have known that without this loss. And a few days later, I was sitting around with a group of friends who had all lost all their money, including my friend Taj. And I posed a question to the group to see, because we hadn't really talked, and said, if you could have had this not happen, would you choose for it not to have happened? And 4 out of 5 of us said, no, I'm glad it happened for this reason. For being given the initiation, being shown. Being shown a place where all is well, regardless of what happens. And then that becomes one's inheritance, one's property, you might say. Sometimes through loss. So just for a few moments, we won't do this for a long time, but let's have a brief sitting. Begin by settling, getting your body in a posture that is conducive to both alertness and relaxation. If you're feeling mental, sense the bottom half of your body very vividly. Thinking's a type of energy, so if you bring the energy down into your body, it balances. Speedier mental energy. Let's give our attention to the breath, but let's not frame it as a concentration exercise, because there's something muscular about that. But see what it's like to take a single inhale with no multitasking, completely oriented towards intimacy, right here. Touch the breath and be touched. And follow the exhale with a sense of nearness. Your breath can be shallow or deep, it doesn't matter. The only thing that we're encouraging is an intimate moment in touch. the activity of the mind may continue, and it can be just like a TV going on in the next room. It's not just where our attention is placed. And perhaps you'll see as you be in touch, be near, that there's just right now future and past or mental . This is direct. Every instant is a portal . Okay, we can relax our concentration. When the orientation is in the what you might call the outer surface world, which is not to demean the outer surface world, it's where our lives happen and so much preciousness and meaning. But when our orientation is solely in that world and the accompanying encasement in the mental world, of this, which is an unfolding now, which is like jazz. It's continual improv, and that's part of the groundlessness. It's like it's not something we control, and it's not something that is based on what has happened in the past. And there's a kind of, this is where the heart comes in, there's a kind of learning to have faith in that and trust that, that allows relaxation. And so much of what we experience is the ego life is a clenched fist out of fear. So relaxation is a very important element in allowing being to happen, to be. And this can be practiced breath by breath, this kind of being. And it's also practiced as we go through vicissitudes in life, like losing all your money or having an illness. It's like in all of these ways, the seeker is oriented towards being in harmony with what is. Flow. That's why I love my basketball team so much, the Golden State Warriors. It's like just total flow. It's fantastic. So I wanted to leave a few moments now to see if anyone would like to share anything or has any questions. We haven't had too much opportunity for that because a short time period, either from today or for those of you who have been here through the course of the week, if anyone would like either to share something or ask something. We won't pass a mic because it's a fairly small room, but just try to speak clearly. Yes.
So, having some experience of that groundlessness, I'm wondering, like, in terms of sharing with people at time of loss and death, I know you can't, really create that experience for somebody to have that, but I also really experience the field in terms of when you hold that awareness. Can you talk some about how that could help in that kind of situation?
Have you experienced holding that awareness and being in those situations? Can you feel like what it's like to be present? And
and it seems like that could be really comforting for somebody in that course of...
Yeah, my experience, the times I've been around death, which is I think has been four times. First of all, it's so profound, and it's interesting. One of the things I've experienced is everybody kind of takes refuge in busyness, and at a certain point it becomes obvious, or it can be pointed out, like good hospice workers do this, that the time of busyness is over. There's nothing that can be done except keeping the person comfortable. And then a space opens. It's very palpable when non-doing has some room. And that's the same in our meditation. A space opens when there's not doing. And, I don't have tons of experience with this, but I, in my few experiences, I find that sometimes the dying person and sometimes the family are open to words, and sometimes they're not. And then, if they're not, though, you just hold the space. And it's such an amazing time because the veil between the formless and the form world is so thinned out, and that's why there can be such a feeling of sacredness. And also, quite surprisingly, sometimes giddiness of joy. When my mother died, my sister and my wife and I were giddy. And we had to kind of stifle it because everybody was coming up to us. I'm so sorry and for your loss. And we were just happy. And it's not that we didn't love her. It's that the freedom of the soul, we were infected by it. So that's another thing about being real and not just being like the conceptually we might have thought we were supposed to be feeling something else. But that's not what was happening. It was fun. And, well, I won't go on. Yes. If what?
If someone spends their life in service to the divine and on the path, if their mind is taken either...
If their what?
Their mind is taken through either old age or disease or something like that, will they still be able to remember the vicar and...
That's such a great question. I don't totally know the answer, but my sister, who is 5 years older than me, got early onset Alzheimer's, and I took care of her the last 4 years of her life, and she had been an earnest Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. And when her mind was gone, she still had something of her limbic brain. And, before her mind was completely gone, she would get upset about not being autonomous and not being able to remember everything. And I used to tell her stories of Sufis who were in ecstasy, and they'd be wandering through the desert, but they had to have attendants. You know, there's Sufi tales like this. They had to have attendants because they were in some kind of state of ecstasy and they weren't functioning. And so I tell her that story that they had to have attendants and they were just in bliss and people to remind them to eat and which way to go and stuff. And she'd get all happy with those stories. And she'd relax. And then I'd have to tell her again 5 minutes later. But later on, her, frontal cortex functionings were gone, but she still had her limbic brain. And we would just sit around and listen to music, and she'd just be sweet. All the way to the end. Yeah. And to the point that there was brain dysfunction to the point that she forgot how to breathe, forgot how to eat. So, but all the way to the end, there was a kind of sweetness that was there, but I don't know if that's true for everyone. I did ask a spiritual teacher once that exact question. I said, I can, this person is a very awake person. And I asked him, I said, what would your, because it was when my sister had Alzheimer's, and I said, what would your state be if you got Alzheimer's? And he said, probably pretty relaxed because I wouldn't have any to deal with the mind. So that was his answer. Yes?
This is a two-part question, but at the beginning you said that we have to remember that the light is independent of the outer world. And so I'm wondering...
I didn't say you have to remember it, well, but you get to.
when one is in a situation where they are faced with violence, not just physical, but verbal, energetic, in that moment, how does one become aware of that? That's the first question. And then secondly, does that mean that one... should be passive, or should they stand up against it, or how do you know that balance of fighting against it or passive?
Yeah. Well, first of all, your first question, I think, has to do with the depth of one's practice and one's station. And what progresses is the time delay. So if one has a strong practice, you might be freaked out, angry when it's happening, but you can come home that night and reconnect and get centered. So you might have a 5-hour time delay. It's possible if you're living, if your station of practice is truly anchored in presence, that you can remain in being while it's happening. But that's a very advanced practice. And it can also, the other end of the spectrum, your practice can be that it's very upsetting and perhaps you have all this reactivity, but over the course of a few weeks you digest it, or a few months you digest it. So practice where you are and just keep the orientation. It does not mean passivity. I think every situation is different, but you know many of the great awakened exemplars in life were warriors. It depends on what one's destiny is and what our situations in life call for. But our practice is, if we are standing up for something, or if we have to become violent to meet violence internally, that's where the real work is. What is our state? That's why I always have felt that if we're going to have capital punishment, we should have the most awakened people being the executioners, so that it's done with compassion. So our outer actions may call for strength, they might call for aggression, but what is our inner state while we're involved in that? That's what the practice is. And it doesn't just have to be violence, you know, it can be in committee meetings. How, like, it's an achievement of awareness to realize that opposition is not opposition does not have to shut down love or kindness or good wishes. Doesn't follow that we have to become bitter in our own hearts in order to stand up strong. I'm sorry? Yeah, that's right. Gandhi, Thich Nhat Hanh, Martin Luther King. It's an important question you're asking. What is it? It's a subtle contemplation. What is it that would make the heart harden because there's opposition, because there's an adversarial situation? And as soon as the heart hardens, I've lost my heart.
Here. Woundedness that is triggered.
Yeah. So one would have to kind of trace back and Any other? Yes.
So what might it look like?
A little louder, please.
Sure. What might it look like to engage in conflict, not conflict, to confront something with, and still be in one's sensitive heart? I mean, what does that look like? What could it look like?
You probably know.
Maybe not. I mean, I don't see from the outside, and I'd like to have a pattern to.
Well, one thing is we have to get over the notion that states are mutually exclusive.
Right.
For instance, kindness and strength can be here at the same time. So as the historical impressions are more clarified and there's less historical reactivity, saying no can be a fairly straightforward act without there being a lot of turbulence around it. It's clean. And there's oftentimes when there's a constellation of qualities present, it's very beautiful that no can be an expression of a strength, and there can be peacefulness, there can be kindness. Just think, the more there's people in the world practicing that. There was a hand up in the back. Yes?
I'm curious about your process of getting where you made up, if you've been able to.
Oh, I never really had much of an issue with that. My main thing about Bernie Madoff is I would always wished I could go talk to him. I was very curious, like how his psyche worked. But I don't know, that just wasn't my thing. Psychosis and schizophrenia, but I don't know too much about it in terms of music.
Or, was in some texts they say you listen to a spiritual saying or something and they just click.
That's interesting. I know it seems as if one of the things about schizophrenia or psychosis, different kinds, is the difficulty organizing experience. Yeah, so I don't know how that would work. But Taj was saying something interesting in her class, for those of you who are there, that it's not that we get rid of this I. The identity of what we mean by I is what transforms. And the reason I'm mentioning this, there needs to be a strong center. There needs to be an I here. And oftentimes, if that's disruptive, it's one of the difficulties with mental instability. There's not a strong enough container to hold and metabolize experience. And that's why it's not good for everyone to embark on an intense spiritual practice. it can be furthered, because what we're talking about is the annihilation of the false self. But you need a strong self first. Let me see if anybody else has it.
So a young woman here asked me this question, and I didn't have a good answer. But she said, you know, we're always talking about, you know, crushing the ego or diminishing it or taking away its sway in our lives. And she said,
poor ego.
She says, you know, I negotiate with mine. I love it. I give it a space where it feels safe, so it doesn't feel like I'm out to get it. And you know, in a way, it's kind of, she deals with her ego kind of like people, you know, would deal with a shadow piece, you know, that a wounded part of oneself that you love and you know, you've done nothing wrong, it's not your fault, but I don't know about the ego. Can you speak to that?
Well, we probably have to define our terms, like different people mean different things, but part of what I think your friend was discovering is how to mitigate the superego, which is like this orientation of the mind that is self-blaming in a critical, unkind way. It says it's my fault, you're bad. That's a skew, that's a distortion of perspective that it needs to be dealt with. It needs to be not indulged. So I think to the extent that your friend is working with a process of self-kindness in that way, it could be quite useful. The thing about, you know, the nafs or the ego that we deal with in the mystical traditions is a mistaken identity. It's a self-centered perspective. That's why going to see the Impressionists is so cool, because it's all about perspective. It's like where you're looking from. And where we're looking from at a certain phase, which is natural, is there's this sense of I that is totally separate and everything else is out there, and this is the central importance. And there's fear in that condition because we're not in touch with the ground of being. It's like it's vulnerable in not the good way. So the same I is here in a certain way, but a certain kind of boundary of isolation is what gets challenged. And the perspective changes. It's more like a 360 situation, like surround sound, surround being. So we're out of time. I want to say thank you in the sense of it's very meaningful to me to gather with people who care so much about what matters most to me too. And to feel in that community, this community. I think we would all do this alone if we had to, but it would be so, such a poverty to do that. So, thank you for your companionship.
Thank you.
Organizational development.